Hey, everybody. Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze, live in St. Louis. We're here with six fucking people, so don't expect me to name them all. You'll hear we're going to say their names later. It's fine. No, because then someone's going to get pissed when I forget their name, and I'm going to be like, well, but I've been drinking, and it's... Okay, anyway, this is Renee, for anybody I haven't introduced myself to yet, and I'm drinking something called Contact High, and it lives up to its name. What are you guys drinking? I want you to yell it out for the microphone in the back.
Self-loathing!
Dakota, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Schlafly Pale Ale, which I hate saying that because it sounds like you're drunk when you say it. So, Schlafly. I don't know. Yeah, Schlafly. Give me a Schlafly. Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, though.
It's really good. And Jessica, are you drinking Blue Moon in a can?
I'm drinking Blue Moon in a can.
Blue Moon in a can, everybody. All right. No, thanks for being here. And before I hand the mic to Jessica, I just want to remind you guys that we have a guarantee to meet tonight. So eat, drink, and be merry.
Okay. Our first reader tonight is going to be Fred Venturini. I met Fred... It was about 1 hour ago, and he remembers. It was awesome. Fred is currently in Noir at the Bar 2, and he's going to have a story out in Surreal South 13, Burnt Tongues, the Chuck B. anthology, and the Booked anthology, which is a podcast, I think. I don't know about them. Fred became an author the way all of us dream of, by accident. He was discovered like a supermodel in a strip mall. He was with Blank Slate Press, and he's moving on to bigger, better things. Very exciting. All kinds of stuff happening for Fred. We're glad he's with us before he's Mr. Hollywood and too good for us. So, yeah, we're pretty excited to get all this started. Fred, here we go.
All right. Okay, hold on. I'm going to put this down. Oh, I like to bend down and just take a pause and just get it when I need to get it. I don't even know what that is. Mike Malone, my hetero life mate right there, got me that beer. This is called The Meaning of Life. I've actually read this one before. I think we have a couple repeat fans in here of this one. This story is like the reason my wife isn't here. She's like, what are you reading? So I give her a list and she's like, we're not going to pay for a babysitter. Well, I'll just stay home. You can go read that on your own. Because it's one of those wife-involving stories, but don't think it's biographical. Otherwise, you probably won't buy me a drink later. It's probably going to be bad. This one's called The Meaning of Life. She sits on the couch watching Dr. Phil, her legs half-crossed. Her elbows hide her tits while she clicks her red fingernails against her teeth. She's drawn in, all of her delicious parts concealed, like she can resist me. A rope of snot dangles from my nose, threatening to drop on the pages of my book. A deft rocking of my chin swings the snot onto my upper lip, where it sticks and begins a slow dribble towards my mouth. I notice, but I don't give a shit. I like my parts. Snot and fingernails and scabs, they're all pleasant to me, varying from fascinating to delicious. Everyone has tasted their own blood or caught a whiff of their own shit, but we want to experience everybody else with their crusts cut off. That's why I love this book, the big, bloody encyclopedia of serial murder. It's so interesting. Murderers love the crust of others as much as they love the crust of themselves. So I'm reading about the less than celebrated serial murderer Edmund Kemper. A criminologist asked him, what crossed his mind when a pretty girl crossed the street? Part of me would like to date her, he said. The other part of me wonders what her head would look like on a stick. The quote is falsely attributed to Ed Gein and Ted Bundy. Bundy because of his well-known cooperation with psychiatrists upon his capture. Gein because of his pop culture celebrity. She will not sit by me because I'm reading this, quote, filth. Funny coming from her. I've seen her escapades in the bedroom, which can make even me blush. She quit her job as a hostess at Lone Star because it interfered with Oprah back when Oprah was still on every day. She has a psychology degree, but she quotes Dr. Phil, not Freud. She drives with two tires on the white line and won't park unless there are two consecutive empty spaces, but she thinks she's a terrific driver. She'll eat a frozen pizza, but not a restaurant pizza. She prefers Sprite over 7-Up. She always jacks up the thermostat, and she insists that she's easy to please. I love the fuck out of her. There, she says, pointing at the television, the nipple shadows against her white t-shirt peeking when her arm lifts. I told Erica like 3 times, whenever a guy says he wants a break, just finish the phrase. It means break up. Who the fuck is she talking to? Me? The television? Herself? Rehearsing for what she would say to someone who cares? People in love don't want breaks, she continues. They're addicted. They'll put up with anything. She needs to realize that Roy just isn't in her that much. He wants to take a break. I should have TiVo'd this episode for her. I want to scream out, who the fuck are you talking to? But instead I say, well, I agree, and then I flip to the next page. Ed Gein's fame comes from one murder, not a spree. He played with the skin. He built the chair from body parts and flesh. He wore his victim's face, stitched together as a mask. He inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He inspired Psycho and countless other horror movies. For Christ's sakes, the fucker has a fan club. What do you want for dinner, she asks. Whatever you're making, I say, wondering what Ed Gein might make. She scowls at me, but I'm not cooking. There's only 50 pages left. We'll order in if you don't want to cook, I tell her. I don't know, she says. Nothing's appealing to me right now, and eating out is costing us like way too much per month. Laziness has a price, I say. Are you calling me lazy? No, we are fucking lazy, I say. We never want to cook. Well, I can't do it all the time, she says, then retreats to her television cocoon. John Wayne Gacy had a pile of dead children under his house. She is pregnant, but not showing. We can still have sex safely, from what I'm told. And there's a pattern in this book. These guys, they're obsessed with sex. I'm obsessed with sex, but not obsessed with killing people. Will the ending of this book reveal how one adds murder to their sexual obsession? Take her, for example. I have to keep the book over my boxers because she'll see my erection. I've been thinking of having sex with her since the last time we finished having sex. There's a bite mark on her left tit. I like to grab her by the back of the neck. I like to jam my face into hers. I just like to kiss the shit right out of her until our teeth clack together. She is that puppy that's so cute you're afraid of hugging it too hard. She's a kitten so adorable you want to drown it. Edmund Kemper cut one of his victims in half and had sex with the viscera. Cords of intestine wrapped around an erection, stomach tough as jerky, tearing open. The gelatin of chyme and blood and semen and half-digested microwave meals all mixing together. Sound gross? Well, it's pretty damn close to actual sex. There's just a slick membrane that separates cock from guts. Just a few millimeters that's the difference between clean sex and humping innards. She's shaking her head now. Dr. Phil's over in 10 minutes. She's wondering if I'm going to keep reading this shit instead of paying attention to her pouting. You have to stop, she says. I wonder if I might have been reading out loud. After gauging her expression, I decide that she's scared, but she's not terrified, so I dog-ear my page. We're in the basement. The fluorescent lighting makes every pore in her skin a crater, but that makes reading easier. The walls are devoid of posters of pretty girls or sports fan-oriented bullshit. The couch she sits on is blue. My recliner in the corner is dirt gray. She calls this the college room. She loves the TiVo. She hates the cold, but sleeps well with no sunlight to wake her. Sheer panic ripples through me, not because of where I am, but because I can remember no other details about the other rooms of the house. Do you love me? She asks. Does our kitchen have green or white linoleum? I can't remember. Absolutely, I say. I love you to the rafters. She huffs and begins clicking her nails again. I open up my book. But not enough to put that fucking book down, she says, just as I delve into a paragraph about Albert Fish. Albert Fish, who liked to use rose stems as pipe cleaner for his pee hole. I can take sports. Or a little drinking. I I can take looking at a few other girls, maybe even gambling. I can understand those things. But this is just weird. It's bordering on creepy, she says. It's just reading a book, I tell her, and then I turn my page. Not when all of your reading focuses on one subject. That predicates a hobby, don't you think? Her and her questions. Everything's a question. When we argue, she answers with a baited question every time. Things like, so you're saying it's my fault. So you don't love me. Why don't we make love instead of fucking? Why can't you make me feel special? Jesus, she should feel special. I don't fuck anyone else. Hobbies cost money, I say. Interests are free. Interests are just interesting. It's sick, she says. You have a psychology degree, I say. You know the signs of a serial killer, animal abuse, pyromania, bedwetting, a fractured childhood. I only have a morbid curiosity. I do not have those signs. There's something to be decoded from their mindset. Do you know how intelligent, motivated, and clear these people are? Like they know a secret that no one else knows? So you're modeling your mindset after serial killers? Like clockwork, she is. Do you know what the meaning of life is, I ask? Let's see how she likes a dose of her own medicine. Why don't you enlighten me, Socrates, she tells me. The year before I met you, I say, staring at her tits while looking contemplative, I took a philosophy elective. That was a question that we had to answer on the first day. I took the simple approach. The meaning of life is to be happy. And Bob, our teacher, he asked me if a serial killer led a happy life. And you said yes, she says. Not a question, but an interruption. I did. I think they're among the happiest people on the planet. They do something they love until it's their eventual undoing. If someone dedicates their life to piano playing, then dies at the piano after creating their masterpiece, we marvel at the dedication and the drive. We call it their purpose, not their addiction. It's not a sickness. Why not at least try to look for positive pieces in the wake of a killer? There is a benefit to their thinking. Quite simply, shut up, she says. Piano players don't hurt anyone. Just stop. Just shut the fuck up. Not a bad idea. I could talk forever, but I've already constructed an escape hatch for this mini argument. The tension drains from my face. My eyebrows slacken. The corners of my mouth slightly rise. This is the mask of self-disappointment. I throw the book into the trash can, but I make sure to dog ear my page first. You make me happy, I say. I sit beside her, my arm lassoing her by the waist. She gives me another shoulder, looking away. Heat radiates from her back. I reach behind her ear, smoothing the blonde hair. I've sucked that hair. It tastes a lot like hair. I'm dedicating my life to you, I say. You're the meaning of my life. In this relationship, this is our masterpiece. And I would never do anything to desecrate something so important to me, so sacred. Sounds poetic, doesn't it? Dennis Nilsson wrote a slew of verse about the men he strangled, dismembered, and flushed down the toilet. Covered in your tomato paste, a man of many parts, I try to forget. Then I massage her shoulders. She turns to me, the tears dribbling off her chin. She snaps up a tissue and wipes my long, neglected nose. You don't have to cry, she says. It's the baby. Mood swings, you know? Her skin reminds me of a button-up silk shirt from high school. The fabric was so exotic and so fragile, I was afraid to wash that shirt, so I never wore it, not once. But it was my favorite shirt. Her eyes are a faded green. They look like wintergreen rubbing alcohol. She shuts them during sex. I know because I watch her face to see if she's faking. So I kiss her. Hard as usual, and she kisses back. But her hands are loose in my arms. She wants to be held. She just wants the purity of kissing without going any further. She initially resists when I start fumbling around the waistband of her jeans, looking to push them down. But she finally relents and says, I love you. I love her too, and she knows it. You can't fake love. That's why I'm so scared. We've been married for 6 years, and we're going to welcome a child into this world very soon. But dear God, I can't stop thinking about what her head would look like on a stick.
Okay, our next author tonight is going to be Salvatore Payne. He's author of the novel Last Call in the City of Bridges, which is for sale in the back. He'll sign it and everything. His works appeared in American Short Fiction, Pank, Hobart, and the American Book Review, The Rumpus, and apparently other places as well. He's assistant professor of English at the University of Indianapolis. The first time I heard Sal read, I basically heckled him as he came on stage and asked him for a limerick. Yeah. After the show, he really did pretend to write me a lyric, asked me what a limerick was, and then just wrote, "Fuck Reggie Miller" in my book. And after... And I knew we had to have him for Books and Booze. So the second time I saw Sal Payne, he sang a karaoke version of Limp Bizkit and broke the microphone. So, and then I knew he had to be here tonight. So I'm extremely happy to have him here reading for us. Fuck Reggie Miller.
St. Louis, what's up? How's everybody doing? Okay. This is sounding good. Oh, thank you. Oh, that's awesome.
Being close to it's good.
Okay. All right, I'm going to read a story and then a chapter from my novel, which is back there. I'm fighting a cold, so if my voice goes out, I'm going to draft my girlfriend to read the rest, so I apologize in advance. Here she is. Yeah, girlfriend. All right, so this story is called Reggie Miller. I did not know Jessica was going to say that, so this works out great. When I'm not working on my novel, I'm writing fiction about 1990s NBA players. Sorry. Okay, so this is called Reggie Miller. You're listening to an audiobook about the history of the Mercury space program when the car accident happens. It's so fast you barely react, barely even comprehend what is happening. You feel your front bumper drop onto the ground, grinding against your tires. The car in front of you spins until your hoods touch. There's an Asian man inside. His car is totaled. There is no blood. He looks at you for one brief moment of recognition. Then his head dips forward and he passes out. The audiobook narrator drones on about Ham and Enos, the first chimps launched into outer space. You're in the middle of an intersection and, unsure of what to do next, open the door and step onto the road. The other vehicles inch around you en route to the Indiana State Fairgrounds, a massive facility resembling a football stadium. Only it houses show pigs and gun shows and other Midwestern oddities you don't quite understand yet. You've only just moved here from Pennsylvania, so different from this alien landscape, flat, blocks upon blocks of abandoned houses, then a quick swath of mini mansions sprawl everywhere. You rub your pulsing neck. The crash becomes clearer now. You see a luxury sedan facing the opposite direction of your car. Its front end is smashed inward like a deflated accordion. You see a black man inside. He gets out of his car. You assume this man was traveling northbound, that he ran the red light, that he totaled the Asian man's car, which then bounced into yours. You bend over to look into the Asian man's car. It's only then that you realize, this is basketball phenom Jeremy Lin. Remember him? That was fun. This is your beloved New York Knicks global sensation, Jeremy Lin. This is Jeremy Lin, unconscious and twisted in a husk of a four-door. Reggie Miller jogs over from the other car. You know you should be shocked it's Reggie Miller, scourge of your NBA fandom, who has run the red light, who has caused this wreck, who has injured precious St. Jeremy, but you aren't. Reggie Miller was an Indiana Pacer in the 1990s. Reggie Miller tormented the Knicks in the playoffs year after year, scoring 8 points in the final 8.9 seconds of a game, making an incredible 4-point play at the buzzer, standing in front of Supreme Knickerbocker loyalist Spike Lee and giving him the choke symbol. his bony fingers wrapped around his neck. Reggie Miller has a fucking lisp. Reggie Miller has cartoonishly big ears. Reggie Miller is the villain, and over time has become a euphemism for everything bad in the entire world. Reggie Miller is the old woman in front of you at the checkout, arguing with the cashier over the price of a cantaloupe. Reggie Miller is opening a pizza and finding the cheese stuck to the top of the box. Reggie Miller is pouring a bowl of cereal and reaching for milk in the fridge, and holy shit, realizing you barely have any milk left, and now you have to eat that cereal dry. Reggie Miller is your best friend from high school, dying of leukemia at 27. Reggie Miller is darkness, doom, decay. Reggie Miller looks inside Jeremy Lin's car. The front end is on fire now. Tiny orange wisps, like a teenager's facial hair. Jeremy Lin was fleeting, Reggie Miller whispers into your ear. You will thank me for this. If he stayed in Nick, you would have grown to resent him when Linsanity died, and you were left with an above-average point guard earning a massive salary. Now you will remember only the good times, the highlight reels. Destruction and rebirth are one in the same, Salvatore, Reggie Miller says. You shake your head, you stamp your feet. Jeremy Lin gave me hope that I might become a better person, you say, that through the transformative power of NBA fandom, that I could become more than what I currently am. What are you currently, Reggie Miller asks. Flawed, desperate human. Reggie Miller opens the car door and smooths Jeremy Lin's hair to the right. This is the faulty logic of an egomaniac. You don't deserve Jeremy Lin. None of you deserve Jeremy Lin. He unhooks Jeremy Lin's seatbelt and pulls his lanky body out onto the pavement. Reggie Miller puts Jeremy Lin over his shoulder and slowly rises into the cloudless sky. He looks at you from above and says, I'll be back for you tomorrow. The next day, Reggie Miller arrives at your half of a duplex with a six-pack of Upland wheat, his potato head face all smiles and cheer. You eventually let him in. And together, you hook up the Super Nintendo and play NBA Jam Tournament Edition while drinking on your Walmart futon. Reggie selects the Pacers and defeats you again and again, again and again. When the final beer is finished, Reggie sinks his back against the couch and releases a contented sigh. This is what I don't understand about you diehard fans, he says, eyes closed. If the Knicks drafted me instead of Patrick Ewing, you would have loved me. The organization would have built around my playing style. All your bluster about loving the Knicks because they were tough-nosed hooligans would have gone right out the window, and you'd be talking about my jump shot and ability to mess with opposing players' heads. Am I right? You're right, you say. So you're completely powerless to the whims of the Knicks front office. You have no choice but to root for whomever they tell you to root for. Am I right? You're right, you say. If they traded Patrick Ewing to another team mid-career, and he came back to Madison Square Garden, you would have booed him. Do you realize what this means? Reggie Miller asks. You say nothing. You're rooting for uniforms, for clothing. He stands up and moves towards the front door. You spend hours watching these games on illegal internet feeds, reading all the comments on Knickerblogger. Great site, it's real. Listening to the Basketball Jones podcast, live tweeting under the Knicks hashtag, think of all the other things you and every other sports fan could be accomplishing. You're wasting your life. You want to tell Reggie Miller about how you ended up a Knicks fan in the first place. When you were in first grade, you collected basketball cards even though you were too young to really follow the games or have a favorite team. When you decided it was time to pick an allegiance, you spread out all your cards over the living room floor and organized them by team. The three biggest piles were 7 Bulls, 9 Pacers, and 11 Knicks. You based your entire fandom on this random outcome 20 years ago, and you want to tell Reggie Miller this, how close you were to becoming a Pacers fan. You want to tell him that sticking with the Knicks for so long, for so little a reason, proves something vital about your character. When they were terrible for an entire decade, it would have been so easy to jump ship to Kobe's Lakers or D-Wade's Heat, but you stayed put, you remained. It's easy for people who live in the same city or even the same state as their favorite teams to stay fans. But for you, a skinny nerd from Scranton who has only visited New York City once before graduation, this surely was a test of inner fortitude. You are loyal to the end, you want to shout. You haven't wasted your life, you want to shout. But you don't shout any of this. You don't do anything but watch Reggie Miller gently lock the front door from the inside and repeat, You're wasting your life. He pulls the knife out of his back pocket. You wasted your life. Okay. Bridget Miller. If you guys watch that guy try and call a basketball game, he doesn't even know what's happening. He'll be like, oh, somebody just scored a basket. I'm Reggie Miller. Cheryl Miller, I'm better than her. But he's not.
Well, it was rumored that our next guest was raised by wolves. I don't have any sources on that. But, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and read his bio because I wrote these down by hand, and so I'm going to read the damn things. J. David Osborne lives in Norman, Oklahoma with his wife and dog. He trims trees and sells hot dogs for a living. He's written a few books. By the time we leave here, We'll Be Friends, which won the Wonderland Award for Best Novel, and most recently, Low Down Death Right Easy, which is for sale in the back there. He's currently writing a 40-part serial about cops, hitmen, aliens, and time worms, called God's Fair No Better, which is fucking awesome, by the way. You should definitely read it. And you can find it weekly at jdavidosborne.com. And his prose hits harder than Jet Air's punch. This son of a bitch can write. Please welcome our next guest, J. David Osborne.
Hi, hello. Hi, how's everybody? There's a beer holder. Oh, wow. That's fucking cool. Okay, recently there was a very well-respected, awesome author who wrote an article about what it means to be manly and how to better, you know, be a man through fiction or something. It was fucking bullshit. Anyway, it really pissed me off, and so since this guy is writing kind of, I guess you would say, being a man means being as horrible as you could possibly be to another human being. I decided to write the grittiest, most manly story ever. And I have that for you now. It's called Gritty. Sam Tatiriga is 100% blue fuck positive that he can whip anybody's ass, and he says as much over the beer he's drinking in a small bar that's got a jukebox and a pool table and probably a bunch of cars parked on gravel out back. He's from the South, which is mostly just dirt roads and people who smoke a lot of methamphetamines, and let's face it, I mean, if you're from an area like that, there's not much to do except whip a lot of ass. So Sam spends most of his time robbing people with a sawed-off shotgun. He'd park outside of motel rooms for hours. Hookers worked at most of these motels, which never had names, just big motel signs that were faded from the hot sun. So yeah, you'd see hookers going into motel rooms to do all manner of disgusting sexual things with men who are no doubt married. These women shoot crack at the dinner table while their feral children eat cockroaches out of cereal boxes older than they are, because the profession they have chosen has robbed them of any ounce of humanity, and if you give them half a chance, they'll tell you how little they care about you, how little the whole thing means to them, and how your efforts to save them are precious, but man, are they ever world-weary and so not here for your bullshit. Anyway, Sam, right. So anyway, he'd watch these hookers work and get blowjobs from the toothless ones in the front seat of his car, and when they go to sit their bony, wasted ass in his passenger seat, he's got to move all manner of used takeout boxes and crushed camel packs and beer cans and bottles of Jack Daniels and even a keg that he brought on a whim, one of those stakeouts that he just sits in the back seat just pumping, pouring red Solo cup after red Solo cup, it never affecting him because he's just kind of this sweaty redneck machine. When he'd get done shooting what is no doubt disease seed down these hookers' throats, he'll beat them until they give him information on the johns they take up to the hotel rooms. Beat them for the information they would probably give up gladly, but we have to establish that Sam Tatiriga is a rather fucked up individual.
So these hookers might, in a moment of rare, I mean blood diamond rare, conscientious objection, refuse to give it up, as it were, and Sam will set about to beating on them. It's pretty horrible, but they're all horrible people, so instead of feeling kind of shitty about the situation, we feel shitty about life in general, and still stick with our old beer-drinking, ass-whipping friend Sam, because he's all we've got in this fucking wasteland. Once he figures out what's up, he robs the shit out of those Johns with a sawed-off shotgun. A regular shotgun, or really just a regular pistol, might do the trick, but there's something sexy about the sawed-off shotgun. The raw, compact power of it. The fact that it kind of reminds him of a pirate's pistol. And the fact that it's immensely powerful and might take someone's head off. That shit just gets Sam's dick rock hard. And the robberies are where he gets his money, to be in this nothing bar on a Wednesday night, drinking whatever's cheapest on tap and whatever's cheapest out of the well. He doesn't have friends, per se, except for his inbred moonshiner acquaintance Bug, who runs a prostitution ring out of his mother's cabin way out in the sticks, probably at least 50 or so dirt roads out there. He takes a break from the ass-whipping to talk... to sing the praises of a website where you can buy laser sights for any kind of rifle or pistol for dirt cheap, which catches the attention of the drunks, who've probably already phased him out, and they nod their heads into their glasses as he describes the GPS targeting system he's going to buy once he sells off all the meth he stole from an acquaintance of a John, of a hooker he beat the shit out of. We're now kind of floating, right, in this miasma of boredom. Those of us not on Adderall, at least. And we're going to need a description of the redness of the dirt, or the smell of stale cigarettes from the bar, or maybe, if we're lucky, a description of a gun or a bone breaking, in order to keep us from moving on to another story with another Sam. Two options. One. There's a young man at the far end of the bar, a clean-cut, nice young man, just home from the war, and he's gonna say something to Sam that will escalate into a conflict, though the young man clearly doesn't want the conflict. And in the end, Sam will beat him damn near to death, and there won't be a single consequence for this, because in this world of hard-boiled fighters and meth addicts, there are no consequences for their actions. There is only the cold law of the jungle. Sam will still die. Maybe he gets shot by a hooker. I don't fucking... Two. Sam receives a call from his long-lost son, who has grown up in a hard way, much like his father. The two have a detached conversation that ends not with them agreeing to meet up or anything like that, but rather with a terse goodbye, because it doesn't really matter that Sam has an estranged son, but rather that his embodiment of darkness will continue. We have the added bonus of now having a bit of humanization we can place on this character, meaning that this offer to fight anyone in the bar will end with a vivid description of his eye becoming dislodged from its socket before a silent Indian type with knuckles dipped in gasoline beats him so bad, we're supposed to figure that he's dead. After he's gone, and that last line has run its course, and we're left with the pulpy, expansive pages between this story and the next. If you squint, Sam Tatiriga is riding a dragon through space and time. The dragon is purple and scaly, and Sam controls it by plunging both of his arms into the two wet holes at the base of the dragon's brain. He flies the creature up past the edges of our galaxy to where two gods in the shape of windmills tower over a swirling purple fog, and they press their heads to their chest, and it glows white. Sam Tatiriga sees all of the options his existence presented, realizes that he's dark, and speeds towards the mouth of one of the gods with a sword growing from the top of his head. He has the thing in his mouth, and everything is a blinding white flash. In the white, he can begin to make out the grains of printed paper, and he sees a big word, gritty, looming over a waterfall of black letters, with him poised to fall into it like the ball in a dexterity puzzle, and suddenly he feels a sequence of written sound enter his chest, and he is 100% blue fuck positive he can whip anybody's ass.
So, Fish Bites Cop, probably one of the funniest books I've read all year. It's amazing. Okay. David James Keaton's work has appeared in over 50 publications, including recently Noir at the Bar, Chicago Quarterly Review, and Grift. He is also a Spine Tingler Award winner and founder and editor-in-chief of Flywheel Magazine. His collection, Fish Bites Cop, Stories to Bash Authorities, is available from Comet Press and back there at the table. And he has hidden DVDs and some of the copies like Willy Wonka and Faces of Death 3. I made that last part up. David's likes include long walks on the beach and getting caught in the rain. His dislikes include cops, fish, and yoga.
I didn't say any of that.
David, can you tell me what this noise is?
That's when I sexually assaulted you on the phone.
Like the call. The
call
just said.
I broke the mic.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Oh, yeah. Anyway, welcome our next guest, David James Keaton.
Hello. Whoa. Yeah, I didn't say any of that stuff that he said. I did smack my dick against the phone when I was talking to him, but out of context, that sounds ridiculous, but that did happen. It did actually happen. We're halfway done. We'd be finished, but Fred read 9 fucking stories. Fred, why are you not paying any attention? Look, there he is. I'm talking shit about you. I thought I was only prepared to talk about Superman for like an hour because he swore he was going to talk about Superman. But he didn't say shit about it, so I don't have anything to say except there's sort of a sports theme emerged tonight, so I'm going to read a sports story. I was really shitty at sports, so this is an ode to all the coaches from my high school. They're all named Smith, and one of them was named Bartowski. So. As I'm getting off the phone, I'm being pulled over, and it's the first cop I've seen outside of the movies in a year. I give him my license, my registration, my full attention, then finally my carefully autographed citation. But I never say a word, and I'm pleased to see this drives him fucking crazy. When he walked up before my refusal to talk, the officer saw me talking into my hand right before I rolled down my window, but it was obvious he didn't want to accuse me of playing mute under the watchful eye of his dashboard cameras. He didn't know that I was simply trying as hard as I could not to use recent news of a tragedy in my life just to get out of a speeding ticket. Minutes before, my brother had called me with news of the latest missing person from our high school, this time the young, bright-eyed basketball coach. And to be honest, I was at a loss of words with him too. Luckily, the cop won't check my trunk because of his frustration at my silent treatment. Instead, he goes through the 3 stages of grief I've become so familiar with right there at my window. Denial, anger, then acceptance. I'm disappointed when he skips stages 2 and 4, bargaining in despair, because he locks up staring at my fingernails instead. Most people do. I find a low road to park out of sight, then start looking for a branch to support my weight. I need to keep in shape with all the funerals turned high school reunions these days. It's a new exercise routine, one that's evolved quite naturally, really. After the suspicious disappearance of our football coach and my reoccurring visions of trying to fold his squat, sausage-like legs into a bag easy enough to manipulate, I felt the need to hang off various stairwells and construction beams at a work site to build up my forearms. After our mysterious missing hockey coach, a discarded shelf balanced on the corner of the dumpster was a good place to work on my wrists, an exercise this man used to swear by in order to develop maximum shot power, never dreaming what it was best used for. And after our incredible vanishing swimming coach, the 3rd suspicious disappearance at our school, and finally a reason for local news to recognize a pattern at other schools in the area, I tried disastrously to do leg lifts to work my abs on the thin metal brace of a truck stop's bathroom stall. It came crashing down before I started to feel a burn, which was even more satisfying. See, what coaches don't understand is that when they make kids run miles until they puke, tackle rows and rows of metal sleds painted to look like snarling quarterbacks, curl weights until their arms go dead, aim for the same goal hoop hole and repeat their throws until an internal gun sight is forever adjusted, hold weights over their heads in the deep end of the pool and tread water until it feels like they're desperately supporting a dead body, piston their legs and the teeth of their cleats into the dirt until they've dug far enough to actually hit water. What they're really doing is giving these kids the physical capability to kill them with their bare hands. This is a danger that so far the coaches of this world have not recognized. My first chin-up bar had been securely attached to door jams for decades, an important first step in waking myself in the morning with quick, pointless workouts before trudging to the gym classes I hated. But the weeks before the empty coffin of the football coach was lowered into the ground, I was on a particularly long walk in the woods and discovered that there weren't any good branches left anywhere, let alone mysterious freestanding doorways that would give me the quick comfort of my morning routine. Then I stumbled over an open grave, and when I saw the black bones knobbed by bulbs bleached orange in the sun, I thought, wait, who the hell was that one? Then I laughed and remembered it was where I started to bury all the barbells I didn't need anymore. I recall climbing a lot of trees all through my childhood like a normal kid, but on that day, it was ridiculously hard to find one with a branch hanging low enough to reach. I needed to do three important exercises, you see, routines that I learned from high school coaches, of course, but with my own imagination taking the place of typical dreams of last-minute victories with a stick or a ball in my fist. First off, simple curls to hit my biceps while fantasizing about punching through my trunk to rip the bumper off a tailgater. Second, I'd turn my hands around to hit my triceps while I imagined dragging myself from the flames of an apocalyptic wreck. Third, I'd twist my hands to hit my forearms, dreaming of hanging from my steering wheel, dangling out the windshield of my car buried deep in the crumbling nose of Mount Rushmore. I always thought strong forearms would be a good backup in any crisis situation. And any of these imagined scenarios allowed me to pull against my own body's heavy blood, bones, and water, way past any reasonable point of exhaustion. A couple years ago, inspired by my religious exercise regime, my little sister tried to mount her own makeshift bar over a spot on the carpet where her cat was constantly puking. The idea was that this placement would force her to exercise forever, discouraging her from ever putting her feet down in that wet kibble. To this day, she continues to step in it, but we're confident that one day she'll be able to stay up on that bar forever. Of course, I knew I'd have to wait a lifetime in vain for a real cliff-hanging situation and the perfect opportunity to amaze any wide-eyed, mouth-breathing bystanders with my impossibly powerful wrists. My favorite daydream was shocking someone, shouting to the gathering crowd, "Holy shit! I thought he was pulling himself up onto that helicopter, but he's pulling it down instead." Hey, it could happen. But I stopped crossing my fingers and waiting for it to happen, endless finger crossings being its own workout, actually, because I finally understood that strong fingers were all you really needed when you were alone in the woods. And crossing your fingers really is better exercise than a decade of red-faced, sputtering coaches screaming in your face to get it up any goddamn day of the week. Fingers are all you need when you're digging. My routine is strenuous, and I know some might wonder why I don't just grab the nearest rifle and storm the school and be done with it the way kids these days are expected to. Well, this was never a serious consideration anymore after I read the news about a neighboring town where some little bastard screeched into the parking lot, popped his collar, cocked his weapon, then headed for the worst memories of this high school cafeteria, only to hear screams and gunshots from inside and realize that some other fucker had already started a rampage. Imagine how embarrassed he was driving home. I can't think of a better reason than that to keep my crazy shit under the radar. After crunching around the brush and deadwood for a half hour, I settle for a branch in spite of its awkward angle. As I try to pull my body up and up and up, I realize that because of the strange slant of the limb, it's forcing me to swing and strain in a completely new way. I realize I'm working a new muscle between my bicep and forearm that has never twitched before. I keep pulling, watching as the tendons and blood bulge in a spot I've never known was alive. As I grunt for a few final curls, I start thinking that if working out is supposedly only to impress females, imagine how shocked they'd be if I discovered a completely new muscle to display. I win, right? You hear so much about the symmetry of the human face, and body being the main reasons for attraction. But has anyone ever tried waving and winning a girl over with one giant finger instead? I can hear the commercial now. One tiny barbell or crooked tree in just 10 minutes a day, and you could create a beautiful swollen digit that would make even the most right-brained, math-loving lady swoon. My dad once said, anyone can watch a good movie, but a bad movie takes endurance. The same thing applies to exercise. Back in junior high, when I was first forced to train for a football season that was an entire year away, I wandered over to the wrestlers' workout, curious since their bodies seemed to be in better shape than anyone else's, with the possible exception of the swimmers. See, the senior football players always seemed like a bunch of bulbous fat fucks to me, and I had little interest in being like them long after my high school sports career was over. Beet red faces, double chins flapping at the bars as they relived all their bullshit, but the football coach caught me watching the wrestlers and yelled, "You want to get strong or you want to walk the beach?" Walk the beach? I mumbled. Wrong answer. But it turned out I ended up actually running on the beach after all, the beach in question being the coach's nickname for the gravel piles surrounding the equipment sheds, a punishment that was eerily like that reoccurring dream where someone's chasing you and your shoes can't get any traction. It didn't matter, though. This was a way better penalty than the dreaded shout of "do laps," where you simply ran until you threw up. He got off on that shit. But I was cut from the team soon enough, therefore only forced to puke once, but it was plenty. Yeah. Oh, Fred's listening. He was the first coach I killed, Fred Venturini, the football coach. Fred loved Superman and he made us watch it all the time. Before the games, he said it would psych us up. Injuries tripled. None of them went out like the way I planned, and Fred was no exception. He would spend most of his life in the weight room, the end of his life too, as it turned out, putting the barbells back in order or sucking in his stomach as he lingered in that one spot in the corner where the mirror showed his entire body from every angle. I knew his routine as well as my own. The idea was for me to brain Fred with a curling bar when he reached around the corner to switch off the lights, but the curling bar slid off the wall and clanged against the ground before I touched it, making Fred hesitate and step all the way around the corner instead. So I reached for the next closest thing, a hockey stick someone had been using to prop open the storage closet. I wound up the stick from my swing elbow high as I anticipated Fred's disgust for mixing up my sports. Then I stared into gray eyes and a cracked and wrinkled face not out of place on a certain national monument. "Only 10 more pounds, pussy," he used to scream when you'd catch him in your peripherals, sneaking two more plates on the bar when you were benching. "That's only two more bags of potato chips." Then he'd leave you struggling with it against your windpipe exactly 6 seconds longer than you needed to. He would have denied it if anyone had the balls to call him out. No one did. I stunned him with my first blow to his ear, and then I brought that stick down so hard I fully expected him to split into two more goddamn coaches. Instead, he croaked and pressed a fist against his fractured skull and crawled towards an exercise bike. He actually climbed a board and started pedaling as if it would help him escape the room. He probably wondered through his glaze of blood in his eyes why the bike wasn't moving as I began hammering the top of his head into a jagged purple Rocky Mountain skyline. No, more like the Black Hills. He finally crumpled off the bike and I jammed the hockey stick in the spokes. I think the dumb fuck actually expected to pitch over the handlebars in spite of his complete lack of momentum. He should have taught science class instead of health. I hope this confusion would follow him off our planet all the way to Krypton so the other coaches would get a good laugh in hell. What's amazing is I wrote this 4 years ago. I carried him out of my back, accidentally leaving the stick behind. At first, I thought it was a huge mistake. Then I discovered that a bloody hockey stick left in a weight room unofficially reserved for the football players had caused a rivalry between the teams, an unattended but hilarious consequence of my actions. Next up was the swimming coach, a smoky little man lost in a perpetual cloud of wheezing. In fact, the summer before he cut me from the team, there was debate about whether such a sorry specimen would really swim at all. Determined not to make as much of a mess as I had with the football coach, I planned on drowning him when he showed up early to chain smoke as always, blue-veined legs wiggling off the end of the high dive like a fucking toddler while he listened to his favorite 80s hair bands, songs that never inspired anyone to do anything, let alone swim faster. Well, until that day, I showed up barefoot, ready to swim, ready to dunk him and hold my breath for a record 2 minutes if necessary. He would have been so proud, but he held onto the diving board like a vice, and I couldn't dump him into the water no matter how many knuckles I crushed under my heels. We struggled all the way back through his portable stereo and stack of music, and I ended up squeezing one of his inspirational sports mix CDs until it exploded, then plunged one of the shards into his throat. It was an easy shot, that vein that always swelled up in practice, the one that signaled someone was about to get coughed and bellowed at, a pulsing target as clear as a fat flashing arrow pointing at that motherfucker's mouth, which is exactly what it was, really. When I think back, I'm still amazed blood poured out instead of smoke. But how can someone fire a starter pistol in our ears every day and not expect a reaction? How many times have other swimmers dreamed of taking that toy gun from his hand and pushing it up his nose until it disappeared? Whose idea was it to bring a gun to practice anyway? And this shit is my fault? Once upon a time, it was a coach who brought the first gun to school. Don't fucking forget it. They started this. But the pool was much easier to clean than the weight room, and neither crime scene was anything like the impromptu paint job the bleachers got when I caught the cross-country coach doing laps up and down the rows after hours. Taking down this man was unexpectedly brutal. Not because of the surprising amount of fight in the wiry little punk, and because he because he high-stepped those grandstands much faster than me, and I couldn't even blame it on the weight of the crowbar I was carrying. He absorbed blows with his hands and elbows for what seemed like hours until his forearms were crippled bags of gravel and water, until he couldn't even make a fist around his broken knuckles. Certainly never tap his stopwatch in disappointment ever again. Luckily, I cornered him in the top row and put him over the rail with a well-placed home run shot of iron to the ear, but nobody would have guessed the power in that hippie. When does baseball season start? At least I won't need to get in shape for that shit. But maybe I should have exercised my legs more, just like he always said before he bounced me off that team, too. He was right, though. Legs are a body part kids forgot about sometimes. But you'd think they could come up with a way to train them without all the puking and attitude, you know? One good thing, carrying that man was as easy as carrying about 50 bags of potato chips. Once all the running was over, I could have piled 100 of those suckers in my trunk that night and never broken a sweat. I didn't kill the basketball coach. He really did just up and disappear one day, but everyone else is in the woods, buried within a half mile of each other, within a half mile of my exercise branch. What is that exactly? 6 times around a football field? Could you run it without throwing up? Who gives a shit? You don't realize this, but the parts of your body that develop strength first, no matter what the exercise, are your fingers. This side effect is considered incidental and almost always ignored, but it actually enables you to dig deep into the ground when you really need to. Try this. Athletes have no idea that this is where all that training really pays off. It's a pity fingers are rarely tested to their potential. Maybe only during those adolescent years where you're not quite ready to fuck yet, of course, but your fingers are more important than you'll know because it means you won't ever need to carry a shovel and a coach at the same time. Hanging off that branch, I realized that anyone can get into shape, but it takes a special kind of dedication to work on something new for no good reason, especially if its purpose is to inflate a mysterious new muscle with blood. You ever see a lizard do those fast, tiny push-ups to engorge that red pouch under its head when it's threatened? Think about this. Our late football coach will never know how effective his offensive line would have been if instead of all the pointless snarling and endless marching in place, he suddenly shouted, "Do laps," instead of "Do laps," and a shock of blood-red frog-like throats expanded under our row of helmets. Opposing defensemen would have shit themselves in fear. Well, at least that or confusion. Two-a-days, he called them. I used to dread those words every summer, but now I'm starting to think two-a-day could be a reasonable goal. This is where my branch snaps and drops me to the ground. It's only about 3 feet down, but since my legs are crossed under me, it's impossible to unfold them in time. So it feels more like 5, well, closer to 50. I'm relieved to discover my ankle isn't broken and it doesn't affect my driving after I make the long, painful walk back to my car. but I'll be forced to disguise my limp during the next funeral because an injury is never as interesting as the potential story, even if there's no one around to hear you make it up, which is how it should be, never the other way around. How does that saying go? If a coach falls in the forest and there's no one around to hear it, you can invent any goddamn story you want. Actually, you don't even have to do that. Everyone else will do it for you. The rampant theories about what's happening to our coaches are much more interesting than the simple truth. Just catch one of your own coaches outside of a weight room, and if by some miracle it just exercised, it won't have any fight left in it. And once they're all on the ground, there's nothing to worry about. People think we're all the same inside, have that same dancing skeleton you see on everyone's front door around Halloween. It's not true. Our bones are as useless as any animal's once they start peeking through the skin. I wipe my hands on my thighs, fingernails black, soil wedged under each nail. The earth is packed up to the root, probably filling my hands, maybe even my forearms by now. One day I will have dug enough with my fingers that the dirt will have filled me up completely. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, so our next guest is actually the first reader who signed up for this event, and he's also the reason that you can hear us, because he brought the sound equipment, so that's kind of a big deal. Coming to us from Overland Park, Kansas, is Gordon Highland, everybody! Yeah! Woo! Woo! All right, he's author of the novels Flash Over and Major Inversions. He's had about a dozen short stories published, and he shared pages with most of the readers here tonight. He's also, in addition to being one of the first people to sign up to read here, he was one of the first people who took a chance on us when we were first starting out. I don't know if everybody here realizes this, but we've been doing this for about a year now. And in addition to being one of the first guests we ever had, he participated in our now defunct music segment because he's not a flake, whereas a lot of the other musicians that we tried to get were kind of flaky. I'm not going to name names or anything. I mean, buy me a drink, and I might, but not right here and now. And that project was Winebox, and by the way, they're fantastic. I listened to their cover of Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes, like, all the time now. Anyway, Gordon's episode remains one of our most popular episodes of Books and Booze. He's a great guy. I got to get drunk with him last night. Really excited to hear what he's going to read for us tonight. So everybody, give it up for Gordon Highland.
What wonderful hosts these people are. I, too, will be reading from Fish Bites Cop tonight. Let me dial this up here right quick. I got a teleprompter here so I can, like, read big print. I'm going to read a couple stories for you tonight. The first one is one that, for some reason, publishers won't touch. I can't figure out why. I'm assuming most of you here have seen Showgirls at one time or another, the movie, right?
Yeah!
Yeah, it always comes on like 1 o'clock in the morning on a work night, and you know I can't look away from the train wreck, and then the whole next day I'm dragging ass about it, you know. But this is not about that. Any similarity to persons living or dead is merely coincidental. This story is called Epicurean. Try not to gag as the glob hangs suspended, creeping its way down the back of your throat. It's just a psychosomatic reflex. 2 more minutes. Keep breathing through your nose for me, please. No, I'm not a dentist. I'm not even a dental assistant. But you're in good hands. I haven't lost an actress yet. When your gorgeous head explodes like a watermelon in Reel 5, believe me, all the time spent in this chair will have been worth it. Alrighty, Miss Gershon, if you want to relax for a few minutes, maybe grab a snack while I get the foam poured into these impressions, then we'll start on the face. Oh, of course, sorry, your face. Bald cap covering her scalp, I first glaze her face in release cream to ensure a clean peel later. It also smooths over imperfections, though her skin radiates impeccably despite being devoid of makeup. a rarer quality than you might think. Even with a dermatological health and an on-call glam squad affords. Then I stir the rubbery alginate mix in a cup, close her eyelids, and brush it on thick everywhere. Two coats, working my way down. With one last chance to glimpse her famous smile, I offer a bated laugh and ask, "So, Miss Gershon, what compelled you to audition for Blue Man Group?" She delivers, beaming with that toothy grin, then twitches against the ticklish bristles as my brush lingers with extra care, a selfish indulgence around those voluptuous lips. My eyes remain trapped in their gravity and wicked secrets held. Or maybe it's just their involuntary telepathic reaction to everyone's thoughts. Good God, what a man could do with those. They'd be my ruin, just like all those starlets that she's seduced on screen. But I dare not talk about such things, instead keeping it light with the usual captive audience soliloquies like a dentist to his mute, paralyzed patient. I hear you guys are shooting the desert sequences in Tunisia. Better pack a parasol. That sun's murder on the dermis. Hey, the Lakers might make a run here at the end of the season, I think. Sucks I had to give up my tickets for this gig, but that would have deprived me the pleasure of your company. You're going to love this once we get it all painted up, G. Would make for a sweet souvenir, you know, if there were anything left after the blast. Still, ought to look badass in 3D at least. Having straws shoved up their nostrils will humble any celebrity, whether they requested the safety precaution or not. I can't resist sneaking a cell phone picture, coughing to mask its shutter click. Her deep, measured breaths whistle, everything above the trash bag-lined breastbone spackled with cobalt blue. After being mummified in plaster bandages and enduring 15 more minutes of my monologuing while they cure, she flexes her facial muscles, as instructed, while I peel off the mold. I wonder if plastic surgeons swell with the same anxiety at their moments of truth. Relief groans from her throat, and the chair back between us suppresses my absurd erection. This one's going to be a big hit. Not the film. No one can predict that. An $80 million gamble on A-list salaries and labyrinthine sets and CGI creatures? No, I'm talking about the mold. In particular, that whiplash smile of hers, sneering with mischief. Elvis had it. So did Billy Idol in his day. But no one's shelling out $6,000 for a life-size silicone replica companion of those guys. Nor did they possess such wanton lips. DSLs, Johnny called them, when I told him who was sitting for me today. Epicurean was another term that he spouted, whatever that means. But hey, he's the marketing guru over at Playthings, and I guess customers with that kind of expendable cash relish such ornate descriptions. So $3,000 gets him the Gershon mold, along with one demo. It's a floor model of sorts. Well, if your floor is the panic room of a machine shop over in Van Nuys. Of course, you won't find her smile in the catalog on their website. Likeness rights? Not to mention the threat of lawsuits over reputation damages. They keep all the celebrity modules custom order. Call it black market if you want. So, $3,000 in my pocket, plus another Benjamin each time they strike a mouth from it. Oh, and modules. I should explain what that means. The Playthings Factory, they offer 9 standard body types in various proportions. Bombshell, athletic, bootylicious, and different ethnicities like mocha, olive, and tawny. But those are just 75 pounds of imitation flesh, a glorified pillow, more deserving of an electric blanket than your affections. What actuates their personalities are the endless selections of add-ons that plug into them, interchangeable modules for the discriminating pervert. Yes, the naughty bits. Most are commissioned from willing porn stars and their most coveted and now patented orifices. The company's claims of authentic feel, however, they deflect contention only because the few men with a legitimate carnal knowledge to differentiate the inner workings of a Sasha from a Jenna by anything other than the contours of their vulvas, well, those guys are not target customers. My current contribution is destined for a 3-input model from the Trinity series. Johnny already has buyers lined up for more, but says to take my time because of some back-ordered pubic hair. I don't ask from where he procures that. So, it's back to work at my real job on the studio lot. Once I've mixed the poly gel and have G's pigment ballparked, I pour a coat of it into the finished mold. This will become the visible layer of skin. Now, normally I'd fill the rest with resin or foam to build up a core, but the whole point of this synthetic body double's detonation for the film. So it's left hollow to accommodate the charge and the random porcine viscera that the team will cram inside for maximum gore coverage within the blast radius. I haven't been privy to the script, but the director explained it as some kind of ultrasonic voice of God that makes our head go boom. Unfinished, the positive resembles Jack Nicholson's version of the Joker, the incognito version from the movie. It's not even sexy enough for its scant few frames of intact screen time. With a finger, I stipple on some red paint, rouging the pores around her silicone nose and cheekbones. A little violet near the tear ducts, subtle, lifelike hues. Then come the more obvious strokes, the gray eyeshadow and the burgundy lipstick. Before handing off my creation to the bomb techs, I run a 3D scanner over it for any digital enhancements that our character may need elsewhere, or any future adult entertainment should playthings diversify. You never know. G posed expressionless, so for Johnny's demo module, I'll need to articulate her trademark smirk via some embedded stainless steel joints. I still have to glue in the teeth, too, made from a softer variety of silicone, along with the stock tongue from the shop. It's fully removable for more headroom. I'm sorry, I should leave the jokes to Johnny. Point being, the playthings version requires far more cosmetic accuracy and posability than her filmed predecessor. She's to become someone's life mate after all, or mistress, or prop, or punching bag. Best not to dwell on such hypotheticals. Of course, I'm taking a career risk, given the inherent celebrity access and trust that my profession permits. These organs that I harvest, though, they're merely bit players in the grand humanoid drama. Once you pair up her mandible with another's eyes or hairstyle, the doll synthesizes its own identity, whose source elements you'd be hard-pressed to deconstruct. Just lumps and limbs and cavities. Our film's effects supervisor, my boss, he calls me Mr. Potato Head, given my knack for pulling any requested body part out of my ass on command. This is the fourth module I've sold, and it's my second mouth. Angelina's remains a top seller, even more than her breasts. That's a little, sorry. I wrote the story like 6 months ago. It's in poor taste. They're probably worth more now. I don't know. Last year, I acquired both of them after casting a full body mold for a CGI film that she later performed entirely in a motion capture suit on a virtual set. She did wear a snatch patch, that's her term, during our private session, though, because there is such a thing as too much detail for an R-rated film. Even if she hadn't worn one, I wouldn't have offered up that bit of anatomy to the market. For one, customers wouldn't trust its authenticity due to lack of comparative evidence, unlike the porn star favorites who keep theirs on prominent display. And two, it would have only been the outer majora, and not the exhaustive anatomical reproduction of her veiled reproductives that purists demand. My very first sale, Uma's feet. Yep, even those are detachable. It's not to accommodate the diversity of fetishes, or at least not usually, but because they wear out the fastest, the feet do. This was before I'd even heard of playthings or had the foresight to sell my molds as golden geese. It was just a one-off. It was a request from the very director of the film we were all working on. He then had his buddy Johnny machine the ankles to fit his existing doll, which I'm told was an early prototype. I doubt the director's identity would surprise you, but I'm going to stick to incriminating myself. Thank you very much. You've got heat, darling. I'll give you that. So tell me, who does your nails? From the workshop floor, I can hear the satire of G's faux Texan dialect rendered in a cartoonish male voice. And even paraphrased, I immediately recognize the scene from that horrid movie. I do them myself. And you, you're just a jealous old whore whose star's fading. It's the same guy's voice, so squeakier now, though, imitating her ingenue scene partner. I release the drill press handle and follow the source of the dialogue into the effects supervisor's office. Pallid under the fluorescent lights, he slumped behind his paper-ravaged desk, his brow knotted as a video plays on his computer monitor. Photographed in a stop-motion tableau, the amateur clip features a plaything doll, costumed in glittering showgirl regalia, her headdress draping her lap. She's seated at a makeup mirror and flirting with her off-camera understudy. Frame by frame, her mouth animates each word with surprising precision. Well, how about you do mine sometime, huh? She says, punctuated with her sly smile. My smile, the one whose every beloved detail I agonized over, the one I'd been assured would go unrecognized in context. Though true of the mouth module alone, Johnny must have sold this guy her entire goddamn face. Dismissing my twinge of awe at its museum-quality realism, I'm reminded that it's also household. It's the star of dozens of feature films and television series, and likely litigious. I'm gonna headline the hottest show in Vegas, the other voice taunts, ever the Pollyanna. Just you wait and see. Surely you will, darling, but first come here and give me some sugar. And that's when she goes inanimate, her mouth locked agape, as the live-action erect penis behind the voices enters frame on a beeline for some passive silicone fellatio from the unwitting celebrity I'd cast just a couple of months prior. My boss pauses the clip, just as the man docks his member. One guess whose agent just sent this over. Why? The surprise innocence wired into my face reads less convincing than G's on-screen performance. My junk looks nothing like that, if that's what they're thinking. I point at the screen, grimacing. Dude's uncut. Well, if only it were yours, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Oh, is that what this is? Well, you'd rather watch the other two scenes? He reaches for the mouse. A forced laugh sputters in my throat. Not unless he busts out a Jennifer Tilly doll. My boss sighs, leaning forward with hands clasped and gaze elsewhere. He posted the name of the company he got it from in the comments. I checked out their site. He squirms, eyes rolling. And I recognize the owner from him hanging around here, taking you out to lunch and shit. Fuck me. And that's how the mold crumbles, folks. I got into this line of work to one day witness my creations up on screens, both big and small, but not this small. My career, my penance, seems destined for the perdition of dildo castering over at the Playthings Factory, assuming their shop isn't shuttered even faster than this one in its scandalous wake. I prefer to imagine G knew that my lascivious intentions all along, and that's what kept that smile plastered across her lips. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
So, I hope you're not easily offended because I'm pretty sure our next reader does not care. Throw that out there. Brandon Teets is the author of the novels Out of Touch and the forthcoming Good Sex, Great Prayers, which I actually had an opportunity to read, and it's fucking amazing, so I hope he's going to read from that tonight. He's had short stories appear everywhere from Amsterdam If You Do to the upcoming Chuck Palahniuk anthology, Burnt Tongues, thank you. Jesus, the beer here is good, guys. If you haven't been drinking it, you need to, I'm telling you. Okay, he's a regular contributor to litreactor.com, and he's promised a hell of a reading. He's going to be giving you free shit. There's going to be games. I'm pretty sure that somebody is going to feel nauseous. I don't know if it's going to be because of the beer, because of what he's reading, but I bet it's going to happen. Anyway, Brandon Teets.
I just flew in from Kansas City, and boy, are my cold sores tired. I drove in. A little sidebar before I get started. I want to propose a toast, if you will. Pop an Adderall, take a drink, raise your glasses to books and booze. This shit is incredibly hard to put together. You guys been doing this for like over 2 months, right? Yeah. This has been getting set up for 2 months. This shit's really hard to put together, so thank you very much for putting this together, inviting us, all of us, out here. It's been wonderful. Good job. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit from Good Sex, Great Prayers. I'm going to read a little bit from Out of Touch. And then we are going to play a game. Now, I know the people in the audience get a little bit uncomfortable getting up on stage, but I promise you, if you come up here, it will be worthwhile. The game we are playing is reality TV rewrites. So, Ray, you need to calm down. I gave Ray a Molly earlier, and it's like peaking so hard. Like, he just wants to be rubbed and hugged. It's great. Okay, so I'm going to start off tonight with a little poem. And I don't really consider myself a poet, so just bear with me. It's probably not really very good. Here we go. Kim Kardashian is a cunt. But did you feel that? Did you feel America become just a little bit better after I said it? Just a little bit better place. That's what America became. All right, so I'm going to read a little bit from Good Sex, Great Prayers. As Renee mentioned, it is my forthcoming novel through Perfect Edge Books. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's sex with a little bit of prayers, more sex, and then a great prayer, then cum. All right. I don't care if she's fat. I don't care if she's got a stinky bologna cooter that cheeses right up like old potato salad left out at a barbecue. You fuck your wife. You fuck only your wife. That's the vow you made. And a man's only as good as his word. Lord doesn't welcome maligners into the kingdom, and there ain't no good woman that deserved to be cheated on just because her puss looked like a pile of hair with chewed bubblegum dropped in it. There's plenty of men locked up that would chop their own ears off for a piece of ass right now. I met him. Met a man that was locked up for a 20-year stretch, and he says to me, Billy, there are times I got so lonesome I stuck my pecker in a mattress hole while looking at my girl's picture. Lord is my witness, she's a pig, but she's my pig. I want you to think about that while you're out delivering our food and supplies and gasoline around our great country. You made a commitment to do a job. You made a commitment to your wife. Do your diligence, do right by the Lord, and be thankful you got more than a mattress to squirt into when you get home. All right, I'm going to do another sermon from Billy Burke. Times have changed. As our prayer and faith evolve, so too does the devil. We cannot rewrite the good book, we cannot recite it, and remain ignorant to the fact that we live in a different era. We've got internet pornography and female NASCAR drivers. We've got pharmaceutical companies hawking us pecker pills. We've got gays getting married for the first time. We've got straights getting married for the sixth or seventh time. Holy union don't mean shit no more. We celebrate sin. In San Francisco, I saw two bulldogs rubbing their hair pies together on a parade float, and the city applauded. Last night in my motel room, I watched some fat son of a bitch try to eat 3 pounds of sandwich while a crowd cheered him on. That's a man versus food reference, if you didn't catch it. The good book never prepared us for that. We can judge, we can cast stones, but ain't never going away. Evil evolves, disease evolves. In this day and age, the devil swoops in with his cock covered in herpes and warts, dripping with gonorrhea and that AIDS juice, and he fucks our women over a nightclub urinal while MTV films it. The devil is everywhere, taking many forms. We need to adapt, gentlemen, and old Billy Burke, he's gonna help you do it. Thank you.